Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
President Trump returned to Wisconsin this week and brought an executive order with him. What were the politics behind bringing Trump back to the Badger State? We talked to political reporter Craig Gilbert. Back home, Governor Scott Walker claims the state's economy is heating up as he prepares to run for a third term. Is it really morning in Wisconsin? PolitiFact Wisconsin rates the governor's recent assertions on that score. And what do Milwaukee aldermen think of a new effort by suburban lawmakers to crack down on carjackings in the city? Mary Spacuzza brings us up to date. All that and more from the best political team in Wisconsin today on Politics. Good afternoon. I'm David Haynes, the opinions editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Welcome to On Politics for Thursday, April 20th. Well, Donald Trump was back in Wisconsin for the first time since his inaugural, and he brought with him an executive order. We talked to Craig Gilbert of our Washington Bureau about how that visit went. So, Craig, Donald Trump was back in Wisconsin for the first time since his inaugural this week. He brought this executive order along to sign with him, but he could have done that anyway. Why come back to Wisconsin? What was it about the politics here?
Yeah, I mean, the backdrop to this trip is pretty interesting. Wisconsin was obviously one of the key Democratic-leaning states that he picked up that allowed him to win the Electoral College, so it's natural for a president to want to come back and work that turf that he knows he's going to need again if he runs for re-election 3 years from now. It's also the home district of the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, and the home district of his White House Chief of Staff, Reince Priebus. So it made sense. It's also a good place, I think, to kind of push the issues that he was pushing when he was back here, this sort of economic nationalist populist message that he hit so hard during the campaign, but that he had seemed to be drifting away from in his presidency.
Right. A couple of flip-flops recently on the Export-Import Bank on whether China is a currency manipulator. So might be a way to firm up the opinions, at least, of his supporters.
Yeah. I mean, and there were two kind of interesting things that stood out about this visit to me. One was, the talk about trade and about blue-collar jobs and manufacturing was expected, but then he waded into this a complicated dairy fight between Canada and Wisconsin, very much on the side of American milk producers. That was interesting. And the other interesting thing was that he, in an interview with TMJ Television, separate from the event, he basically endorsed Tammy Baldwin's Buy American provision, which was something she's been working on for a long time. It basically would require American supplies and products to be used in certain water infrastructure projects. But here, Tammy Baldwin is basically the Republican Party's number one political target in Wisconsin next year. And he endorsed one of her signature issues. And it's also an issue where, like some other issues, there's some distance between Republican President Trump and the Republican Congress. There are a lot of Republicans in Congress who aren't too crazy about these Buy American provisions.
Mm-hmm. And what about the order itself? Just how much impact is that likely to have, or is it really more political theater?
I think it's more symbolic and rhetorical than anything else. I mean, the order itself is very limited in its concrete scope. It talks about reviewing policies and restrictions, and it's very limited in its concrete effects, but it does harken back to, you know, what we think of as Donald Trump's sort of signature campaign themes.
And you mentioned Tammy Baldwin. You wrote recently that her political prospects for 2018 for her reelection bid look a little bit better. Why is that?
Well, I mean, her numbers are slightly better than they have been in the past, but the main reason is that had Hillary Clinton been elected president, it is almost always a big burden for members of the president's party in the midterm elections. It's just there's so much. The political forces are always working against the party in the White House. Almost invariably, the party that occupies the White House loses seats. And so you would have had basically a third Democratic term in the White House, and Tammy Baldwin kind of working in a midterm election where the turnout trends are typically against Democrats to begin with. All the arrows would have been pointing against her. But now there's the possibility of a much better midterm cycle for Democrats, and that could overcome, you know, some of her vulnerabilities. She's going to be the number one target for Republicans in Wisconsin, but she could have the wind at her back instead of in her face as a result of Trump's victory over her candidate for president, Hillary Clinton.
All right, Craig Gilbert in Washington. Thanks so much.
Anytime.
So I'm now back in studio in Milwaukee with Mary Spicuzza, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and Dan Bice, columnist. Dan, let me turn to you first. So what's happening with the governor's race, which is next year? The Democrats don't seem to have a strong challenge yet for Governor Scott Walker.
They don't. In fact, most of the activity are people that have thought about running ended up dropping out. And mm-hmm. this week, Joe Parisi, the Dane County executive, mm-hmm. announced that he was not going to run. And that adds to a growing list of others who have said they won't run. Jen Schilling has said that. Ron Kind. Mark Tauscher had a draft movement, and he decided not to. This Madison businessman, Mark Bakken, said he wasn't running, and I'm sure there are others. And so we get to a smaller and smaller list of people who want to challenge him. And, you know, the time's starting to run short because it's going to be an expensive campaign. And
let's talk about two things. One is who is left, and secondly, what is the time? How soon do they have to have a couple of realistic candidates?
There are basically four candidates left, and I wrote this week about one, Andy Gronick, who's a Milwaukee businessman, and he's been polling about 2 weeks ago. He started polling on a number of issues. I'll talk about that in a second. The others, Dana Walks, a state representative from Eau Claire, Susan Happ, and Senator Vinehout. So those are the four who are left. Andy was polling on a number of issues. He was comparing himself to some of the other candidates. He was interested in people's opinions on Act 10, school vouchers, and just a question about raising taxes for pre-kindergarten programs, that sort of stuff. But I talked to him, and he wouldn't discuss how many people he polled, what his position was on any of these issues, or where he is on deciding to get in.
Let me turn to Mary now. So that question about timing, a statewide race is complicated, especially if you haven't run one before. How soon do the Democrats have to have a couple of reasonable candidates?
I would say soon. I mean, you have to build name recognition. So somebody like Scott Walker, people have an opinion about him, but they also know who he is. A lot of these candidates, I don't know that anybody statewide would know who Andy Gronick is. So it takes time to build name recognition. You could have tons of money, but you need to start getting out there.
Susan Happ has run a statewide race
sure.
for Attorney General, which she lost three years ago.
And a lot, you know, and Kathleen Vinehout, there were people who wanted her to run for governor. I mean, she was...
And she thought about it.
Right, in the recall.
Seriously, and then she had a car accident. And decided not to run.
I think it was like an icy road crash, so she ended up not running after that. But, you know, so she has probably more name recognition than some of the private business owners, and I think that the thing is they just kind of need to start getting their names out there and... building some kind
of...
Mary Burke got in. She got in, what was it, September, October, where she really got in very actively the year before. But she did end up putting a fair bit of money into the race.
And she had a fair bit of money, so that helped.
And I think Gronick has some money, but the others, I don't think so much.
All right, so what we're really talking about here is, does the Democratic Party in Wisconsin have its act together? And the Republicans are arguing on a website that they don't.
Yeah,
they wrote about
the Republicans set up a website called Democrats of Disarray, in which they just run through a number of these candidates dropping out and some of the other stuff, like a story I wrote about Democrats playing bingo during the State of the State and so forth. So, the Democrats have lost a lot of seats in the legislature. Republicans control every branch of the of the State House, the legislature, governor's office, and Supreme Court. So,
and for a while, we've been seeing poll numbers showing that Governor Walker was or is vulnerable. His numbers have improved, but for a while, he was stuck at 38%, which is not great heading into wanting to run for a third.
That's for an incumbent,
right?
Typically.
And he's—I mean—he has improved slightly, but his presidential run was pretty disastrous for his poll numbers. The budget, this last budget before this one, was not popular. So they've had people have had time to think about this because he was not pulling off the charts popularity. Right.
But he does have an operation, and a very effective operation, and each candidate who steps up and says, I might run for governor, each Democrat candidate who steps up and says, I might run for governor, you can expect the Republican Party and we to do a lot of vetting of those candidates. And, you know, today, a lot of stuff's getting around about Gronick's poll because he asked about the opinions of Wisconsin Indians, not Wisconsinites.
So,
rookie mistake.
Yeah. So, and there's a question that the Republicans are raising as to whether he could be polling without a campaign committee. He said he's testing the ideas of the Wisconsin voters. The Republicans are saying you have to have set up a campaign committee before you can do that. So that'll be unraveling in the next couple of days.
And Walker kind of has a playbook here. And then off your election, you pile up the votes in the counties around Wisconsin, around Milwaukee and outstate, and that is just enough.
And you have an effective opposition research team, which which he does. So. But, you know, the thing is, there is a, you know, he peaks at about 52% in elections. And so he doesn't have a lot of margin for error. And his best hope is to make sure that he has a weak opponent in the next election.
Okay. Well, we wanted to continue to talk about Governor Walker in this upcoming campaign. He hasn't announced, but it's presumed that he's going to run. He's making all the right signals for running. We talked to Tom Kircher of PolitiFact Wisconsin, who examined recently some statements that the governor has made about the Wisconsin economy. So I'm joined now by Tom Kircher, PolitiFact Wisconsin reporter. Tom, welcome.
Thanks, Dave.
So Governor Walker, who's gearing up for his reelection bid in 2018, has been saying things around the state like the economy's in great shape. And what has he been saying? What did you find?
Right. A couple weeks ago on his weekly radio address, he said Wisconsin's economy is in as good a shape as it's been since 2000. It's a bold, broad claim, caught our attention. So we decided to check it out.
And what was the rating that PolitiFact Wisconsin gave that?
We rated his statement half true. It's partially accurate. On some measures, Wisconsin's economy is as good or better than it was in 2000, but not on others.
But it goes farther than that. So the unemployment rate clearly is in great shape. And I think he's also said, I'm not sure you rated this, but he's also said that more people are working in Wisconsin than ever before. Also true, but there's more to it than that. So unemployment rate, very low, but what about other measures of employment?
The unemployment rate, of course, is an important measure, but it's pretty narrow. That's the one he relies on a lot. And in fact, it is as low as it's been. It's under 4%, as low as it's been since 2000. But we also looked, after talking to a half a dozen economics professors around Wisconsin, we looked at other measures. And in this case, the labor participation rate, that's down from 2000. What's important there is it indicates there are more unemployed people who have stopped looking for work.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And you also looked at average wage and yearly income distribution. So what are those measures and what do they mean? What did you find?
Yeah, wages are pretty much what it sounds like, the wage you're paid at work, although it also includes things like benefits. And we found that wages are, in fact, higher now than they were in 2000, taking into account inflation. Mm-hmm. But then we also looked at income, and what we found there is people at the upper end of the scale, the top 10%, now have more income, again, taking into account inflation, than the bottom 90%. In other words, they're farther ahead, the top 10% are farther ahead of the bottom 90% than they were in 2000.
Which, so even if the average wage is up, more of it tends to be going to people at the upper income levels.
Income, not only from wages, but things like investments. And the income measure we looked at also takes into account things like welfare benefits.
Okay. And then finally, you looked at GDP per capita. So that's gross domestic product per capita and the poverty rate. And explain those and what did you find?
A gross domestic product measures our productivity, so all the goods and services we produce in Wisconsin. And that measure is up compared to 2000. But the poverty rate is also up. So, you know, overall, really it's a mixed bag based on the six measures we looked at recommended by economics professors. Some of the measures, three of them, unemployment, wages, GDP, are all better than 2000, but income distribution, the poverty rate, and the labor participation rate are not as good as 2000. So that's why we came up at half true for Walker's statement.
All right. So Tom Kircher of PolitiFact Wisconsin, thanks so much for that update on Governor Walker's statement on the economy. So Mary, let's bring it back home now. There's been this debate in the Milwaukee Common Council about this package of legislation proposed by suburban legislators involving crime in Milwaukee, specifically carjacking. So what's going on with it? What are the politics behind it, and how have the aldermen reacted?
Right. So the suburban lawmakers proposed this package of eight bills, which is actually getting a public hearing at the Capitol today. It deals a lot with repeat violent offenders. It's targeting carjackers, but it deals with it would send more like repeat offenders, juveniles, to Lincoln Hills, which is obviously the troubled school up north that has been in our paper quite a bit lately. But they're arguing that these are people who have repeatedly shown that they are violent and that they should be sent, that we should be sending more people instead of giving them so many chances. Some of the Common Council members fully endorsed that. They did a news conference last week where three of the members, who tend to be the more conservative, stood up with suburban lawmakers in West Dallas, talking about how kind of places like West Dallas are the next front and it's spreading into the suburbs. But then it went to the Common Council on Tuesday for their meeting, and it was clearly not a unanimous thing, and the vast majority of the council voted to send it back to committee to talk about it more, saying that the solution is not more incarceration and Lincoln Hills is not a place that is rehabilitating young people, and basically said we need to talk about prevention, and sure, we need to have punishment, but they were concerned about essentially locking kids up and throwing away the key.
This sounds a little bit like what happened with the school system and the suburban legislators, where Dale Coenga and Alberta Darling wanted to do the takeover of the schools, just get someone to take over the MPS and everything would be fixed. But the people within the system kept on saying the problem's a little bit more complicated than that, and not much happened as a result.
So obviously with the death of Ziggy, the city worker who was killed on duty in an attempted carjacking, this has been brought to the forefront once again. There's been talk about, you know, what do you do when somebody is young but is committing serious crimes? How do you rehabilitate them? And at what point should they be, locked up?
Mm-hmm. There's been this question, too, about police pursuit policy. Is that an issue?
Yeah, and part of it is, somebody like Alderman Bob Donovan, who is a one of the more tough on crime council members, says that part of the reason kids are stealing so many cars is that they feel like they can do so without punishment because they're not going to be chased. He calls it a no pursuit policy, which Milwaukee police does not agree with, and they do some pursuits, but there is this balance of what if you chase somebody and then they crash into somebody and kill a bunch of people in a car, and what is the threshold for chasing somebody? I think, you know, obviously if somebody carjacks and there's been a gun in somebody's face, I think they're more likely to chase than somebody who has just maybe stolen a parked car.
Are the numbers on carjackings in the last two or three years? Are they up, down, or are
they? They, like homicides, I think that they have been increasing to a point that people are getting increasingly nervous. Although for this year, it might be slower this year than last year. We'll just have to see because it's pretty early.
Well, last year it seemed to get a lot of attention with the carjackings. And to be fair, I think everybody agrees that there is a huge problem.
Yeah, I would hope so. I mean, it's... Right.
The difference is how do you solve it and how easily can you solve it? Can you solve it with a couple of bills, or do you need something else?
And part of the pursuit policy debate is also that there have been a number of pretty disturbing hit-and-run crashes lately, and those aren't necessarily all carjackings, and I don't think these have been, the most recent one was a carjacking. But I think that the concern is that if somebody's driving recklessly, do they feel like they can do so without punishment because they're not going to be chased?
Well, I've heard that complaint repeatedly around town.
And this is an iteration of a standing conflict between the more conservative members of the council and the leadership of the Common Council, where Bob Donovan and Tony Zelensky and others want to do something, you know, a quick fix, and that they're generally in agreement with the suburban legislators on what needs to be done, but the leadership led by Ashanti Hamilton disagrees.
Mm-hmm. And there was obviously a lot of talk this week about black male incarceration rates in Wisconsin, which are high, and will that just increase if they start incarcerating more African-American men?
Well, let's move on now to winners and losers for this week.
And our favorite part of the show.
Our favorite part of the show. And Mary, I want to start with you. Who's your winner?
I'm going to go with Tammy Baldwin. You know, typically the president comes to town, it would be somebody in his party that would be the winner. But in her case, she got a very full-throated endorsement of her Buy American plan, where he was asked by Charles Benson. Donald Trump was asked by Charles Benson if he supports Tammy Baldwin's plan. He said 100%. You know, basically, like, yay, Tammy Baldwin. So I would say that a week that the president from an opposition or from the other party comes to town and you get a full-throated endorsement of your plan,
could
you're a winner.
Could there be a campaign ad in the office?
Yeah, maybe.
I suspect so. So who's your loser?
I'm going to go with state Dems. Obviously not Tammy Baldwin, but clearly they're going to have to come up with a candidate for governor to run against Scott Walker at some point in the near future. And it just seems like every time we read about candidates, there are people who are saying they're not going to run.
Right. And so you can't beat somebody with nobody.
Right.
So despite what his numbers are,
he could be stuck at 38. He could go back to 38% approval rating, and if they can't find a strong candidate who's going to have time to build name recognition and get some campaign contributions, they're going to be in a tough spot.
Just ask Supreme Court Justice Annette Ziegler about that.
Sure.
Who ran unopposed in April and got a 10-year term out of the deal.
Right.
And
nobody knows what her approval ratings are, and they didn't matter.
Her favorite race, probably, yes.
Yes, that's a great race if you're an incumbent. So, Dan, who's your loser?
Wisconsin Watchdog, which is an online, I don't know, what would you call it, website that does
conservative
stories.
News website?
Yeah, and news and commentary. You know, they led the attack on the John Doe investigation, been very aggressive in covering that, as well as other issues.
They've written about you.
They have written about me.
Full disclosure.
a number of things about me, but it looks like they're having major financial trouble. Their parent organization, the Franklin Center, and one of their staffers said that it was shutting down. The parent organization says we're just reorganizing. Whatever is going on, it seems to be certainly struggling and may be dead.
And so, Dan, who's your winner?
My winner is in politics with the two-party system. It's a zero-sum game. So if there's a loser, like the state Dems, the winner is Scott Walker, who certainly benefits and, you know, is indicating he's going to run for re-election. And now you're down right now to, I mean, you do have the 25-year-old kid who's running. But,
oh, right.
But outside of that, you've got four people, and you can expect the Republicans to focus on those four and any flaws that they might have. So
we didn't even plan that, which just happened.
So let's go to a couple of questions. And Mary, the first one's for you.
Okay.
A reader, Daryl, wants to know, basically, as I'll paraphrase here a bit, but wants to know, don't the juveniles who are committing the carjackings understand the consequences? And he also asks about the pursuit policy, which we've touched on. But what about that question of how do you create consequences for young adults who live in these neighborhoods and are involved in criminal activity?
You know, this was also a topic of debate this week of our judges being too lenient with repeat juvenile offenders. That's something that Mayor Barrett has talked about a lot, about Chief Flynn. I think somebody like Bob Donovan would say they don't have serious consequences, and that's why they keep doing this.
And that's been David Clark's point repeatedly.
Sure. But then if you talk to some of the other council members, they will say, you know, these could be somebody, they could have grown up homeless, they could have grown up to drug-addicted parents, they could have had a lot of obstacles that in their lives where they're young enough that they could turn it around, and the focus should be prevention and rehabilitation and not necessarily just off to Lincoln Hills with you. So I think that is something we're going to hear more about in the coming weeks, especially with this hearing today.
So the short answer is many of these kids feel like there are no consequences. Right. That's why they do it. Mm-hmm. So the
last question that we'll take is a name that I could have sworn would come up in the show by now, and that is Bill O'Reilly, who lost his position.
Oh, he could have been our loser.
He could have been. Lost his position at Fox News. Longtime cable news commentator,
week, right? Mm-hmm.
And the reader wants to know. First of all, compares what O'Reilly's alleged to have done with what President Bill Clinton was alleged to have done, and wants to know exactly what was it that O'Reilly is accused of doing, and why is it such a big deal, Mary?
I would say that, you know, this wasn't a case of one woman coming forward and saying that he sexually harassed her and that he was fired. This was repeat cases of different women coming forward, and not just, some people said, oh, he was just flirting. I would argue there's a difference between flirting and pressuring a subordinate to have sex with you or engage in a sexual relationship where they feel like their career is on the line. And some of these women, if you read some of the articles, said that they were punished because they did not have a sexual relationship with him. They mm-hmm. weren't offered spots on the show. They were cut from the show. They were promised a job, didn't get the job. And I think you have to be aware that there's a position of power where somebody like Bill O'Reilly, who was making, what, $18 million a year, is going to have more power than somebody who's a contributor or trying to get started. And it sounded like he often took on a mentor role where he would kind of offer to take an attractive young woman under his wing and help them with their careers. And then it was, well, there's this. So I would say that there's a difference between flirting and basically being a serial sexual harasser.
Yeah, several things. You know, his response was this was just because he was famous and people were targeting him and so forth. But there are other people at Fox News who are famous who didn't have this problem, Sean Hannity being the main one. You know, you don't hear about problems with people like this.
I don't remember hearing about Greta Van Susteren or Megyn Kelly sexually harassing young male staffers.
And there's also the fact that Roger Ailes just recently had a very similar problem. So there's this perception, whether it's true or not, that Fox News was this haven for sexual harassment. So they had to deal with that. And, you know, Rupert Murdoch's two sons who were coming and taking over Fox News with him wanted to deal with that. And then finally, there's a business aspect to this, and that is that the Murdoch family wants to buy Sky Sports and News in England, and they tried it once before and had to withdraw their offer, and they're going to be under a great deal of scrutiny as to what they're doing with Fox News when they have this application pending.
And I wouldn't underestimate the advertisers who, by the dozens, fled his show over the past week.
A lot of that as well. So there are two business aspects to this as well. And, you know, in TV news, that plays a big part.
When did the first complaint against him come forward? I think it was 2002.
2004 was when it was settled.
Okay. So I would say that it's not like he was just kind of fired immediately when somebody brought up an allegation. This was a long
time.
Five
allegations, a couple more that have come out since then. So, I think it was the New York Times story that galvanized all of this by putting it all together to say $13 million that's been spent, five women in the past, and now others stepping forward.
And one particular accuser who never sued and was not under a non-disclosure and went on and did interview after interview and wasn't after money. So she couldn't be accused of being a gold digger.
Right.
Kind of makes you wonder if maybe there's some more cases coming up or more.
That one came forward just yesterday anyway.
So.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, with that, we'll end another edition of On Politics. Mary Spacuzza, Dan Bice. Also, thanks to Craig Gilbert and Tom Kircher. I'm David Haynes with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Thanks for watching.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.